is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. On today's show, we're devoting an entire hour to one topic, sober homes. These are a relatively new approach to helping people struggling with addiction that have in many ways sprung up in response to the still increasing number of overdoses as the opioid epidemic continues to worsen. The number of overdoses in Lee County has increased by 800% in just the past 4 years. Sober homes are kind of like halfway houses, but not exactly. They're essentially safe and stable homes for people who want to get clean, often led by someone who has struggled with addiction themselves. Many of them are explicitly faith-based with a Christian message at their core, but not all of them. We're doing today's show to shine more light on some great reporting that was done by Patricia Bournes. She's the social justice and services reporter for the News Press. Her recent feature on sober homes drew our attention to it. Patricia, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks, Julia. Good to be here.
Becoming a frequent guest, a frequent flyer miles. I'm also joined by Pastor Craig Hunt from Recovering Lives, which operates a or several sober homes in Lee County. Pastor Hunt, welcome to the show. And we're also joined in studio by one of its residents, Amber Boley. Amber, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Both of you. How many homes do you have right now?
Currently, we have one, but we're under lease for three. By the end of the year, we'll have three on a campus.
Okay.
So, total 27 beds.
Great. Yeah. And as always, we invite our listeners to join the conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Patricia, I'm going to start with you. Give me some basics. How many sober homes like this are operating in Southwest Florida?
So that's a great question, and one that I wasn't able to answer except, in a very informal way by Googling, essentially, and also looking at certified homes. And what I found was mainly in Lee County, about 45 to 50 homes. Chime in if you think something different. And I counted that might be about a little over 200 beds, maybe 400 people if you consider that there's two per room.
So was it hard to figure out exactly how many there are because are they not regulated or certified or licensed? I mean, is there kind of a state repository that lists these?
For sober homes, no. No, I couldn't really find that. There is an organization now that is collecting those that choose voluntarily to certify. And by certifying with, a set of best practices that, have been decided by people who decide best practices, you can then refer to treatment centers or vice versa. And I think that you'll be talking to State Attorney Ehrenberg at some point, and he can talk about why that law passed in 2016 exists, what that's meant for. But otherwise, I think that the reason that these homes aren't, quote, regulated per se is that people who have addictions are protected by the fair housing law and they're entitled to live anywhere, just like everyone else.
I think some of the appeal might be to not be in a registered place that has names and numbers and all of that information too.
Sure.
For the people that are going to stay at these homes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And many of them, because of the kind of NIMBY effect, don't want to give out their address. People are concerned about, retaliation and discrimination. And
NIMBY,
like
not
that.
In my backyard. That took me a minute.
I'm sorry. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, other than the listing of certified homes, I looked on Craigslist. I looked on Google.
So it's kind of a word of mouth almost, like an anecdotal way to find it. How are these different from halfway houses?
I think that Rosemary has a lot of experience in that regard. My sense is that halfway houses are kind of an older incarnation of this and that they may have grown out of treatment programs and provided a little bit more treatment, access to treatment. And Rosemary, maybe you could – Rosemary might be able to address that.
Go for it, Rosemary.
Yeah, okay. We have to go back a little bit. There's always been halfway houses that folks can just come to stay and hopefully they'll strengthen their opportunity for sobriety, for long-term sobriety. But no treatment took place there in general. But then the state level 4 halfway house kind of housing, that was continued treatment, but not as intense as it is in standard residential program. It's they can continue to receive services. They can get a job. They can join family members at that point because they have a little bit of strength in their sobriety after they completed the residential program. So it's a little longer term, usually about 3 to 6 months is average length of stay in a standard halfway house. Out on the – now, these are licensed certified housing.
These seem like – they sound like much more regulated.
Yes, absolutely they are.
So and this the sober houses, like you were reporting on, Patricia, kind of sound like more of an organic response to a crisis that we're facing.
I feel that they are. I feel that partly they're a response to a void of housing, essentially, that this is pretty much for some people the only option other than the street.
Yeah, the lack of affordable housing in our area, I'm sure, plays a pretty major role in how difficult it is to get on your feet once you got knocked out of your housing. Right?
Right.
So I want to turn to Pastor Hunt. I want you to tell me a little bit about your story.
Okay. Well, I actually grew up in a crack house with my mom for several years. I was getting high with her by the time I was 16 years old, and I was a heroin addict, full-blown heroin addict by the time I was 18. So I was exposed to massive amounts of drug addiction. Both my parents passed directly as a direct result of drug addiction. So grew up in Chicago, Illinois. My grandpa had finally retired down here in Florida, and I had overdosed for my fourth time. All my friends were dying around me from overdoses. And I had a situation where I almost died, and the ambulance drivers they almost didn't bring me back. And
did that happen here in Southwest Florida?
In Chicago.
Oh, in Chicago.
And I knew one of the guys I was getting high with. He died in my room that week. And the guy that was supposed to have come down to Florida with me, when I jumped Greyhound that night, because I knew I was going to die. It was just a defining moment. I knew I could either run to Florida or I was going to die. And the guy I was getting high with, that I tried to convince to come with me, he didn't come. He died later that week. And so everybody was dropping. Everyone was overdosing around me. So I came down here and went to my grandparents' house, and they suggested I go into Solace Care. And I went into detox for the first time and then transitioned after detox down to St. Matthew's House.
So it was the first time you'd ever experienced detox?
Yep.
How many years had passed since you were 16 with your mom at this point?
Oh, yeah. I was on the streets for about 7 years. I lived, you know, outside, homeless for a lot of years, slept on a cardboard box underneath awnings at churches, and I had deep woods off, and I was a professional panhandler. I panhandled 24/7. But there was a lot of nights, I mean, I was out of my mind. You know, I thought people were trying to kill me. I was hiding behind bushes, behind trees. I was out of my mind.
Is it kind of common that people continue on this path and they get to the point where people start dying around them? Is that an eye-opener for a lot of people?
It can be, and hopefully, you know, they don't die. I know a lot of them accidentally die because they, you know, obviously they don't know how much they're going to shoot that night. And then they start dosing higher doses. And then one day they're sensitive, like their body's just sensitive, or, you know, their tolerance goes down, and then that's the night they go. But that was my rock bottom.
So you got here to Florida, and mm-hmm. you went through the detox. Mm-hmm. Was that it, or did you?
Well, I went through St. Matthew's House, and I went through about 10 halfway houses. So for me, recovery was a process. I went through, you know, I'd get 90 days clean, and then I'd go back out and get high, and, you know, I'd get hit hard, and it was a process. And each time I learned what I did wrong previously, I matured, became more and more disciplined. And by about 2005, I had finally gotten clean. I've been clean since. So it's been almost 12, 13 years.
So then when did you get into the idea of working with sober homes and opening up a sober home?
Right.
mean, when did you decide that now you can help other people too?
Right. Well, I had a lot of ministries and a lot of halfway houses that really helped save my life and sewed into my life. For example, I was in the New Life Dream Center for almost a year. They house 100 men and women off the streets. I was in Teen Challenge. I was in Oxford Homes. I was in Job's House. I was in Anne's Restoration House. I was in a lot of houses. I was in Noah's House. And through the years, I had a lot of experience with halfway houses. And each time, they were always there to help me come off the streets and help me, you know, get back up and try again.
So. It's quite the network that you ended up growing, amassing over that series of years and going from place to place and meeting so many different people. Did that help you along your path in learning how you were going to deal with the different people that you encounter now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, every step of the way. There was hundreds, if not thousands, of people that contributed to my recovery. I say all the time, Southwest Florida and Fort Myers is like the recovery hub of the world. It's amazing down here. And I'm so grateful to have come down here, and I'm so grateful that my grandpa moved down here.
So religion became part of this for you.
Yeah.
Could you have done this, do you think? Do you think you could have made this recovery? Could you be staying in recovery if you did not have religion? Your faith?
No, not at all. I do believe that spiritual principles and the application of spiritual principles is still the solution.
It kind of sounds similar to Alcoholics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so now I'm
in some ways, because Alcoholics Anonymous talks about a higher power. But
right.
With your group, with what you're doing with the sober homes, it's mm-hmm. very clearly defined as a Christian God.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. So the God of our understanding is the Father of Jesus Christ. So we understand the Father through Jesus. So whenever we ask a question, you know, what would the Father do? We just look to the life of Jesus. No big deal. So we still have a higher power. It just happens to be that the revelation, our understanding of who God is found in the teachings of Jesus Christ. No big deal.
Can people be in your sober home without embracing Jesus?
They can, actually. Our whole goal is to grow them. And believe it or not, most of them began realizing that Jesus was the recovery master. In fact, Jesus applied and worked every step in the AA. In fact, we just did a teaching the other night, step 11. All of it Jesus did in the Bible. So he literally was a recovery master. He's my sponsor. He's my leader. And ultimately, he's my pastor. So
I can see the smile growing across your face as you talk about it. So clearly,
yeah.
It's definitely working for you.
Yeah, he's helped me a lot. And I think that becomes clear later on. That you know, the teachings of the Bible are an asset to recovery, and the fellowship of recovery is an asset to, I believe, Christians, born-again Christians who are in the church as well. So I see the two as an asset to each other, not a liability. And I try to bridge the two, actually. Some people in church talk about recovery. Some people in recovery talk about church, and I try to bring the two together. So
mm-hmm. It's pretty interesting, and it seems like your youth probably works to your advantage in being able to understand younger people, because it seems like the curve of people that are needing recovery is getting younger and younger. The average age has gone from 34 to 22, the number of people that are addicted right now.
Right. Yeah. And most of them, you know, I see a lot of times recovery is kind of stages. Some people need programs at first. Some people need detox at first. And everybody's on a different fight. Sometimes they need jail. I tell people all the time that, you know, deliverance is really being dragged away. And I had to be dragged away in handcuffs. I had my bouts in jail, and I thank God for it. I thank God for jail. So, you know, everybody plays a part. The county jails do. The cops do. Solace Care does. The detox does. And literally, I partook in almost every step of the process in all of Lee County.
There's no one magic bullet is what you're saying. It's not one magic one thing. It's a number of things.
Yeah, it's a process.
And for a lot of people, like you said, like yourself, it's a process and mm-hmm. it takes a while.
Yeah.
And it takes a little bit of maturing inside.
Mm-hmm. And so the halfway house, it has its place for people who have graduated programs and are ready to transition and ready to go back to work and ready to lead successful lives. And
so
who are able
to
do outpatient. You know?
How do people find their way to you?
Word of mouth, you know, people in the programs, you know, it's kind of word of mouth. But like I said, it has its place. It's for those who are ready to transition. Some people really aren't ready for halfway houses, and they find that out later. And they really do need programs, and they need time to really sit and meditate on where their thoughts are at, where their mindsets are at, and really, the psychosomatic issues there that have to be taken care of in mindsets. And you know, so we hope the best for them. And some people we actually, you know, refer them back to what they need, but they don't always want to go.
Yeah, and for some people, religion may not be a thing for them too. Maybe there would be people that be resistant to embracing that as well.
Correct.
Have you had some people be turned off by that?
I haven't. Most people, I think, adhere to the idea of God in some form or fashion and are open. Recovery teaches open-mindedness, so do we. And so, you know, real quick in the steps, you know, by the time they get to step 3, God is already mentioned. And, you know, AA and the 12-step, and the 12 steps are pretty much in almost every secular type of program out there. They're supportive of that. And God is at the center of it. So
at your place, your sober home, there are no medications allowed. Like none of the drugs that are used for medication-assisted addiction treatment, none of that is allowed at all.
No, yeah. They're allowed to have their medications.
They are?
Yeah.
Okay.
The only medications that aren't allowed, there are specific ones that are, you know, privy to abuse. For example, gabapentin, I think, is one of the lines that we draw, only because it's abuse. It's a highly abused substance. And there are some that do have legitimate neurotic nerve damage. And those we take by case-by-case example. Like if someone's had, you know, previous nerve damage or legitimate seizures, then they're considered and they're approved. But even then, still, it has to be careful and guarded because some of the other residents in the house may try to abuse it.
Well, I think it kind of helps, too, that your past experience would help inform your awareness of what could be abused, too.
Oh, yeah. And not only mine, but I get a lot of help from a lot of girls in the house because every day there's new substances coming out, you know, that are class 2 and class 3. What's the one that now that everyone's doing that they're getting at the smoke shop?
Kratom,
for example. There's some girls coming to the house now for kratom abuse, and that's why they're there.
But I don't even know what that is.
Exactly. And it's a new substance that's legal now. In some counties it's not, but in the state of Florida it is, and even I think some states.
It's an opioid effect.
Yeah.
It's a natural opioid. It comes from the bark of a coffee-related tree. And you can buy it right in a head shop on US 41. It's I think it's just illegal, or it may have been illegal in Sarasota County. Otherwise, it's legal in Florida.
It seems like we're just trying to play catch up to get ahead of all these things. And like with the sober homes, kind of playing catch up to get ahead of the need for places for people to go when they're dealing with homelessness in a place where it's almost impossible to find an apartment for yourself when you're in recovery.
Yeah. I don't know of a halfway house that has an open bed.
They're all full.
And with a waiting list.
Yeah. And you're opening two more by the end of the year.
And this still won't be enough.
If you're just joining the show today, we're learning about sober homes. Several of them have opened up in Southwest Florida that are faith-based. And I'm joined in studio by Pastor Craig Hunt from one such home called Recovering Lives, as well as one of its residents, Amber Boley. Later in the hour, we're going to learn about another sober home at Salus Care that's operating that's non-faith-based. I'm also joined by News Press reporter Patricia Bournes, whose recent feature story on sober homes caught our attention. Has the opioid epidemic impacted you or someone in your family? If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Amber, I want to pivot to you now. You've been sitting so nice and patiently. Tell me a little bit about your story.
From like the beginning, right?
Well, you're at Recovering Lives now. What led to you being there?
I was in a halfway house before I came to Recovering Lives. I was in another one. And I knew something was missing. I wasn't happy in the home. Not to put any names out there or anything. But I was just not happy. And, you know, I was staying clean and I was wanting to stay clean. I was just, there was a lot of like chronic relapsing in the home and everything. So I heard about Recovering Lives through a friend. And, you know, I'd spoke with the director at the time and came there. And, man, I've been there like almost 3 months now. And, you know, I've been in recovery since March. And within this little bit of time that I've been there, like I'm just so much more happier and loved and stronger in my recovery being there.
So there's something different about this particular place versus other places.
Yes.
So you went into recovering in March?
Yeah.
How long had you been abusing drugs before that?
I started using when I was a teenager. But the real hardcore, like the IV drug use, you know, and everything, that started when I was about 24. And was kind of on and off, you know, but I was still always using something, you know, whether it be marijuana or, you know, or just not using the needle. But I married a drug dealer when I was 16 years old. So, I mean, here and there, you know, I would use as well.
Are you still married?
I am still legally married, but I'm in the process of a divorce.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what happened to make you seek help in March? If you're comfortable sharing.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Like I had shared, you know, in the news press thing, I was brought out to Broward County at the end of last year and beginning of December, so about a year ago. And my husband was absconding from the police. And long story short, he brought me out there. And, you know, like I said, I was, you know, I was promised that everything would be okay. We can get clean. And I was – I had experienced addiction here. I'd been through a lot here. You know, I'd even done things as far as, you know, prostituting and stealing and robbing and stuff for the drugs with my husband. But out there, it was like a different ballgame. It was crazy. Like Miami, Fort Lauderdale, you know, and it got really bad. Sometimes, like now, I'll think back about things, but there's so many things that happened within the 2.5 months I was out there. It's just, it's
kind of hard to put the pieces together.
Right. Because it was just constant, constant chaos every day. You know.
So in March, you just pulled yourself out.
Right. My one of my best friends I grew up with, Giselle, she came out there, or she did. She put an Amber Alert out for me.
Oh, you were missing from her, yeah.
Yeah, on Facebook. And had spoke to somebody and somehow gotten in touch with my husband's grandmother who lived out there and found me. And she told me just to hold on and that she would be out there. And it was so bad that I was using drugs and still sick. Like, I was dying, you know. I was dying while using. Like, it was that bad.
So you went into recovery in March, and you went to one place, kind of like a halfway house, you said?
I went to treatment first in Port St. Lucie. Her, uh-huh. her mother worked at a place, and they got me a grant to go into a 28-day program.
So you went into a 28-day program and then after that went into a halfway house.
I came back to Lee County to her house and I had a little slip up before that and ended up going to detox off Evans at St. Louis Care.
Uh-huh.
But from there, walking out of detox with no plan, my own choice. You know, there are such great people there. They help people to try to help them to find a halfway house or triage or somewhere to go. But I had no plan. I left with no plan, but I did not want to use. And so I went to go walk on the side of detox with my bag of stuff. And people were pulling in to say, Liz Karen, they're like, hey, you want to come to a meeting? And so I went into a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody worked together to find me a halfway house.
Great. So, but that wasn't really the one for you. And then you found your way to the sober home that the pastor here was working. What was different about it that filled that need that you had?
The difference is for the first time in my life, I didn't have to feel ashamed to open up and to, like, I felt like the house I was in before didn't really care so much about recovery, you know, that it was more like I understand it's a business, you know, but it's, you know, supposed to have a balance of that with caring and recovery and everything. And like I was doing everything right at the other house, but the one thing that was missing was my relationship with God, my higher power.
So that was the thing that did
yeah,
it for you.
Yeah. That I know that is what did it.
Did you know that was what you were seeking or did you discover that when you found it?
I discovered it when I found it, yeah.
What did you – when you first saw the laying on of the hands and the group prayer, what did you think?
It's honestly not anything I had ever seen before. So I was a little, you know, I wasn't scared. And I'm kind of like very humble and I keep quiet. I don't talk, you know, I might observe something. But once I experienced it, it's an amazing experience and feeling.
So Patricia, you were there when they were having one of these services and the pictures that accompany the article are stunning. Obviously, Andrew West, correct?
Andrew West, yeah.
Every
he's
time,
wonderful. Yeah.
Isn't he?
Yeah.
But it looks very different. How did you feel when the services were going on and people were feeling so emotional?
Open-minded. I think the pastor knows that I'm not a religious person. But what I can say is that I felt that. I want to say this, and I think I wrote in the story that there was kind of a high of its own in that experience that may fill people. You know, I have some concerns about not just the faith-based, but about sober homes generally, I guess, or that, you know, that, you know, I guess what I felt was that a lot of people who were there may not have had experience with religion particularly in their lives, mm-hmm. with prayer, with ritual of any kind. And I think from being there, I began to see, you know, it actually may be possible if you stay at this that you may get it, you know, which has never happened to me before and may not. But, you know, I could see that it could. But I could also see the potential among these very vulnerable people that they're so hungry for relationship and for
the non-judgment.
For non-judgment and mm-hmm. for stopping this horrible life. You know, as much as you want it, you don't, you know. And that here is this, like, safe beach, you know, and that you might do anything to hang on. I mean, that you may accept all of this just because you want to be there, because you don't want to be back on the street, because I did see that as a possibility, especially for people who've not been there that long. But I don't want to say that that's a bad thing. I just want to say that I think that it takes a while to develop a religious, you know, muscle if you're ever going to get one. You know.
Develop a religious muscle.
Well, I don't know. I'm sorry.
No, it's just an interesting. I hadn't heard that phrase. So I wanted to add one part of the article that you did wrote. It went like this, and I'm going to go ahead and read it here. It's a quote from you, Pastor Hunt. Quote, "The first time I saw laying on of hands, I left the church angry. It's like you're around a bunch of people who are high at a party and you're sober." And then Patricia, you write, "The service filled with music and fire did seem to offer," because it was a bonfire, "did seem to offer a high of its own, fortifying the residents with messages of God's unconditional love." An opiate user from Naples who experienced the gospel at New Life, Stephen Curzina. Sorry, Stephen, if you're listening, explained its appeal. "Any drug you do is a spiritual thing. So when addicts get sober, they are open to the spirit realm," Curzina said. I wanted to ask you, Pastor Hunt, I mean, how accurate is that? I mean, there's the feeling of fulfillment and, you know, kind of filling a void, right, with using drugs. Is that then replaced by the filling of that void by the unconditional love of God through a religious experience?
I call it an ease for your disease. Believe it or not, God's presence, whether it be in a meeting or the Holy Spirit, whether it be in a meeting or it be in a church gathering, brings an ease to your disease. There's almost like you come out, you feel better. The worries dissipates and disappears. Obviously, if you start refocusing, you can draw it back on. But there's an actual physical cleansing and washing that takes place in God's presence. And so we experience that and the change afterwards. Sometimes it's a temporary change, but once you leave that atmosphere and your mind begins focusing on the problems of the world, you know, you start worrying again, this and that, it goes away. But it's literally released by a renewing of the mind or a shift in focus. And as you shift your focus into the solution and what God is able to do and what God can do, and He becomes bigger than all your problems, including your addiction, there's literally a release of spiritual power from the inside of a person into their body. And what it does is it literally gives an ease for the disease. It casts off the obsession of the mind. It removes the craving of the body. And it literally is a spiritual solution that the body longs for, that is found in a shifting of your focus. The 12 steps does it, and biblical principles, which are the 12 steps, they shift the person's mind so that they can release from the inside out the spiritual power and the ease for their disease that their body always longed for and didn't know that it needed.
Do you ever feel overwhelmed with responsibility because of the people that are there at your sober home? Because as Patricia mentioned, they are in a very vulnerable state.
Mm-hmm. Not at all. In fact, I feel spirit-led many times, and there's things that I say and I do where I just know that God is using me. You know, so but the alternative is a lot of them are driven in prostitution. They could very well be out abused. My mom was a prostitute. My stepmom was murdered in the Pontiac River. She was a murdered prostitute. I mean, I've seen a lot of them abused. Some of the girls that come in, they're extremely, of course, vulnerable, but at the same time, very anxious. A lot of them are very fearful because they've been abused for such a long time emotionally. And you can hear the nervousness in their voice. I mean, you could see it on them. And to see them begin to glow and blossom and find peace and find rest in the psychology of their thinking, their mindsets begin to change. They begin to trust God more, and literally the burdens begin coming off of them, and they begin believing that they have purpose and that they can do it and they can recover and they can get their kids back and they can live a good life and that God can turn it around. And once you see the change, you never want to do anything different. Never.
It's hard to argue with that.
I would say that at a service, you do feel the love that's there. You know, in that moment, you do.
Yeah, but I understand, though, also the trepidation when people are in such a vulnerable state, because there are not everybody is actually a godly person. So there are people that sometimes can go into these types of things and not have the best intentions and not be as pure of heart.
Correct. Yeah,
sure. So,
but. Conversely, though, that can happen within churches. That can happen within city organizations.
Oh, that can happen anywhere.
Anywhere.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. That's there are bad actors in every part of the world, in every aspect of life. We are exploring sober homes on today's show. They're a new approach to the growing opioid epidemic, which continues to worsen here in Southwest Florida. And I've been talking with Pastor Craig Hunt from Recovering Lives and Amber Boley, who is a resident there, as well as News Press Social Justice and Services reporter Patricia Bourne, who has been covering this issue. And I'm going to bring another voice into the conversation now to cover another angle of this story. Dave Ehrenberg is state attorney with the 15th Judicial Circuit. He joins us by phone from West Palm Beach. Mr. Ehrenberg, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thank you.
So I wanted to talk to you about the Sober Homes Task Force that you put together. What led to that?
Well, state attorney, we had heard in this office about many rogue sober homes that were popping up that were taking advantage of people in recovery and contributing to neighborhood blight. And so we looked into it and found that federal law protected sober homes under the Americans with Disabilities Act, Fair Housing Act, that there was very little that local governments could do to provide oversight over sober homes. And state law was largely absent. And so we went to the state legislature and said, hey, we need you to change state law to give us, you know, more powers to go after patient brokering and insurance fraud, and let us have some local governments have some reasonable regulation over sober homes. And the legislature demurred, thinking this was just a Palm Beach County problem. And so they encouraged us just to do a task force instead. So I said, okay, I respond. I'll start the task force. But in legislative speak, task force usually means kick the can down the road. So I said, if you want to make it real, let's just put some money behind it. So they gave us a one-time grant of $275,000 to start a sober homes task force. And so we did. And as a result, since the start of our task force in July of 2016, we have made 58 arrests and have had about 28 convictions so far. We have largely cleaned up the drug treatment and sober home industry here in Palm Beach County. There are still issues and there's still some problems, but
so there's an industry over there. You're saying it's unscrupulous sober homes that are taking advantage of people. What are they doing?
Oh yeah, what they do is they are in cahoots with a drug treatment center. So the drug treatment center sends them. The sober home sends the drug treatment center's patients, their residents, because there cannot be treatment at a sober home. It's just a house. And in return, the corrupted treatment centers will kick back money because they get insurance money for the treatments, and they'll kick back money to the sober homes. And the sober homes, in turn, will reduce the rent or even charge no rent or even give illegal gifts to the residents. And so you have a vicious cycle where everyone gets paid, everyone gets benefits, until the patient ultimately leaves in an ambulance or a body bag. And this is what we call the Florida shuffle, where it's not a recovery model, but a relapse model.
In order to just keep the money going.
Correct, because under the Affordable Care Act, there is no limitation on the number of times you can go through recovery, through treatment, each year or lifetime. There's no limitation. Plus, addiction is a pre-existing condition. And so the Affordable Care Act has helped many people overcome their addictions because of the availability of treatment. But on the other side, it has attracted rogue elements within the industry to take advantage of people in recovery because there's a new pot of money out there. And the reimbursement is on a fee-for-service basis, not an outcome-based reimbursement model. And because of that, the bad players often get paid more than the good players because they are performing more services, keeping people in an endless cycle of relapse, and it is a truly despicable model that ends in people dying and the bad guys being enriched and the good providers losing their patients and sometimes even having to go out of business.
So with the Sober Homes Task Force, are you trying to put together like a best practices type model or something where people voluntarily certified? And then if you do have something like that, how can someone who is coming off the streets know enough to research to find out where they can go and what's the best place to go? I mean, what's the plan?
Right. Well, under our Sober Homes Task Force, we have a law enforcement task force where we investigate, we prosecute the bad players in the industry players who are committing insurance fraud, which is a felony, who are committing patient brokering, which is pay-to-play, the kickbacks, those are felonies, the deceptive advertising that lures people down to Florida under false pretenses, that's also a crime now under the new laws we helped pass. But we also have two other task forces, civilian task forces, that have recommended changes to the law, and that included in the changes which we got passed through the legislature, one of the changes is exactly what you mentioned, where there is now incentives to refer people to licensed sober homes that are licensed through a group called FAR, the Florida Association of Recovery Residences. And so it is a voluntary certification process, but under the law, a drug treatment center cannot refer people to an unlicensed sober home. And now under the changes of the law that we helped create, a sober home cannot refer people, their residents, to an unlicensed sober home cannot refer their residents to a drug treatment center. So we have created incentives to get licensed through FAR, but the bad ones still are not licensed through FAR. They don't want any part of that. They want to exist under the surface, under the veil of darkness so that they're not regulated, there's no certification, there's no inspection. And those are the ones we're trying to rid our community of.
So your task force is going to then try to, how are you going to do, I'm just kind of trying to think of this from the point of view of a person who's dealing with addiction, they've gone through detox, they've gone through 28 days, and they're walking out the door and they don't know where to go.
Right.
Is your group getting to those 28-day programs and getting together with them to get people into the certified sober homes?
Well, if someone is looking to get into a sober home, we recommend that they go to the Florida Association of Recovery Residences and make sure that their sober home is licensed by that organization. That is number one. Now, as far as what drug treatment centers to go to, that's a little tougher because there's no just one standard. There are a lot of criteria up on the web about what to look for in a drug treatment center. SAMHSA, which is a federal agency, has some criteria up there. But you have to be a lot more discerning than people are right now, where right now you will go to a drug treatment center that just advertises on Facebook or Google, and that's not good enough. You need to do more due diligence than that. But what our job is as a law enforcement agency is to crack down on those who are violating federal, state, and local ordinances, all the laws and the ordinances. We crack down on those who are committing crimes. And we've helped clean up the industry here in Palm Beach County that has led to a 40% decrease in the number of opioid overdose deaths in the first 9 months of this year compared to the same period last year. But what we have found is that when we get rid of a lot of these rogue sober homes and drug treatment centers, they have moved to other places like Southwest Florida. And so we want to offer ourselves to communities around the country, especially in our state, to help them rid the communities of these corrupted treatment centers.
So while I'm sitting here talking about the perspective of the person that's actually addicted, this is probably also really good advice for friends of the addicted, the person that runs to the rescue to do some of that due diligence that an addict may not be as likely to complete.
Yes, very important. You know, you can go to a place. I was just talking to the person who's in charge of the Karen Renaissance Treatment Center, and on their website they have a list of criteria, things to ask for. Does your treatment center have a full-time clinical director on staff? Things like that. But they said that, look, they admitted to me that since they're in the business, their criteria would seem to be self-serving. So they encourage people to go to SAMHSA, which is a federal, you know, agency and website, and to do their due diligence. Because people do more due diligence on the purchase of their next cell phone than on their rehab center. And you would never do that if you had, like, a heart condition. You wouldn't just say, hey, here's a Google ad that says they're offering great treatment. You would never do that. But for drug rehab, that's where a lot of people get their treatment. And for Google, until they change their policy, and I want to tell you about that, that was something they charged the most for, the keywords that most people clicked on, and that's how they promoted the rehab centers. It was pay to play.
Yeah.
Google has since changed their policies. We had a grand jury we impaneled here in Palm Beach County that recommended that Google must change their policies, and they did. So now treatment centers must go through a vetting process before they're promoted on their site.
Dave Ehrenberg, State Attorney for the 15th Judicial Circuit, I want to thank you for your time today. I appreciate you telling us a little bit more about what that task force is doing.
Thanks for having me on.
I really appreciate it. We are exploring sober homes on today's show. They're an approach to helping people struggling with addiction that's becoming more and more common. Many, if not most, are faith-based, like the one run by Recovering Lives that we've been learning about during the first part of this show. But not all of them are. And so now I'm joined in studio by Rosemary Bosvert. She is the Recovery Residence Administrator at Salus Care, which has opened a secular sober home in Southwest Florida. Rosemary, you chimed in a little bit earlier, but welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And I'm also joined on the phone by Yolanda Smallwood. She's a resident at the Salus Care Home. Yolanda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And also still in the studio, we have News Press Social Justice Services reporter Patricia Borns and Pastor Craig Hunt, who runs Recovering Lives, and also one of its residents there, Amber Boley. So, Rosemary, tell me a little bit about Salus Care's home. How long has this one been in operation?
Actually, we're just celebrating our first year with Recovery Residence. We have had halfway houses since 2000, but we have just become certified. We received our FAR certification last December is when we housed our first person.
Mm-hmm.
So now, currently, we have 19 beds available in four specific units.
All right. And also, I wanted to ask, what is your policy regarding medications and things? There's some that won't let you have anything at all. What is Salus Care's stance on that?
Well, right now, a lot of the medication assisted treatments or therapies, many houses will not allow them. You know, it's total abstinence. We still strive for abstinence from the drugs of choices and the illegal and the legal drugs that are abused, prescription drugs and so on and so forth. However, we understand now, and this is new for us, but we understand now that medication-assisted therapy or treatment has its place. There's some people, everyone has their road to recovery. Whatever it may be, it may be strictly faith-based, or it could be a combination of all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
We realize now that some of these drugs do have meaningful places in some people's lives. Currently, we have two that are on the Vivitrol treatment, and they've got nothing but good things to say about it. We are going to be going to our agency-wide is going to be going to more medication-assisted therapy. We just came on board with a new doctor who is certified by the American Society of Addiction Medicine, ASAM, and he's going to be helping our agency and oversee our agency's transition into medication assisted therapy along with our standard practices. But with our recovery residences, we won't be prescribing them per se. They will have to get them from their doctor or wherever they're going for that treatment. But we will allow it. But our job as an agency will be to maintain all the safety precautions we can because they're going into a house with other folks in recovery. So our role is to make sure everybody's safe.
Mm-hmm. So Rosemary and Pastor Hunt, I wanted to ask both of you, what's a day in the life like? Is it an incredibly structured day? Does structure work, getting up at 6 o'clock, doing chores, doing this, that? What is it like?
Well, at Salus Care Place, which is the name of our recovery residence program, they go out and get a job. They work with their sponsors. I encourage them at the initiation of this program that they should have dinner together because this is their sober family.
So it's just like you're a roommate in a house. And going on to continue to try to live your life.
No, this is a family in a house. That's the way we look at it.
Right.
Everyone has its place. And
it's got to be
family-like.
Family.
It has to be.
I agree. Yeah, because that's what a lot of them are missing. they're missing love. They lack love in their families, and they're always trying to fill those voids. And they need the support. And if you treat people like residents, they're just there to collect rent.
Yeah,
that's a different spirit about the house. So even like for example, Recovering Lives. My wife and I for almost 10 years, we've always housed in our home up to 8 people at a time in our own home. So Recovering Lives is an extension of our own home. And they are some are children, some are my daughters. Some are my sisters, and even some are my spiritual mothers in the home. And so we treat each other with respect and like family and with the utmost love. Oh, I agree. Yeah.
So, Yolanda, I wanted to ask you, you're staying there now. Does it feel like a family to you now?
Yes, it feels like a beautiful family, family-based home. We enjoy each other. We do have dinner together. We have a lot of get-togethers.
How long have you been there?
Well, I've been at Salus Care since December 27th. My clean date is December 23rd. I went through the 28-day program. I successfully completed that, and I went on to halfway.
It sounds like you gave yourself a Christmas gift.
Yes, 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 it was. Yes, it was.
So you're coming up on a year now. How has that journey been for you?
It has been a great journey because I moved here from Buffalo, New York. My daughter and son-in-law live in the Cape, and at the time I couldn't move in with them. So I stayed at the Salvation Army at the time, the homeless shelter, for 90 days. I completed that successfully. I got an apartment, got my first job, and I got my first paycheck, and everything broke loose.
Everything broke loose how?
I started using heavily.
So you just
because they live in the Cape, they live so far away. So I was lonely and I didn't know nobody here. And you know, well, us addicts, we know where to find it. And I started using, and everything started going downhill from there.
And then in December, you decided that you wanted to clean up.
Yes, I had to clean up.
What precipitated that?
Well, I didn't like the way I was living. I didn't like the way I looked. And my grandchildren were being affected. And that really hurt me, even though I did this program for myself. But my grandchildren look up to me. And for them to see me the way I was at that time, it devastated me very bad.
So now you're coming up on almost a year. And I'm wondering, then, what is your plan? What do you want to do?
Well, my granddaughter was also born on my clean date, so we're going to celebrate our year together. We're supposed to be going to Disney World, so I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, that'll be nice. And so are you looking for an apartment? Are you planning on staying in this area, moving out to be near your kids out in Cape Coral?
Well, I'm going to stay in the recovery residence for a while because I'm not ready to be by myself. That was my problem, living somewhere by myself. So I like being around other peers, people that are focusing on their recovery like I am. So that helps me stay focused. So I'm not in a rush to move out on my own.
Well, that kind of makes sense. Sounds like a good idea. And Amber, I wanted to ask you before we run out of time, what are your future plans?
Well, I am in the process of getting my 3 children back, my 3 boys. And I just want to, you know, recovery is a lifelong process, you know, and doing the steps and everything, you know, as you grow and everything. But eventually, like with the things like that I've been through, you know, I know I was given this life for a reason, no matter what I went through. But I eventually want to go back to school to become a counselor, social worker, to work with other addicts or abused women, things that I've been through. But my main focus right now is, you know, to work on myself, my recovery, and you know, take it one day at a time.
So how – now you're going to be now maybe getting the boys back?
Hopefully, yes.
And then you're going to want to get into an apartment probably, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So you're going to stay probably in this area?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right. I wanted to ask, Pastor Hunt, you were talking about your future plans. You have two more homes possibly happening? Are they for sure going to happen or?
Oh, yeah. We have the lease agreements. It's just a progressive. We'll move into them progressively. So the second home opens next month in January, and the third home opens in May 1st. So we're
but it seems like there's such a need.
A huge need.
And once you get those two open, you said they're going to be pretty full pretty quick.
Yeah. And we're actually looking at another property as well. So I think what we have is going well, and we're excited for how well it's going. We have more than just a house. We have a support system of people that come to the ministry as well, and we supplement the expense with tithes and offerings. My wife and I don't take a salary. We're completely nonprofit. In fact, we take it at a loss, but we're willing to do it at a loss.
Do you feel like these smaller homes work better because it can create more of that family environment rather than like a giant building that would feel more industrial and clinical?
Yeah. In fact, that's why we hold our ministry meetings in the home, because we actually moved into a storefront for a season and everybody kept telling us, we love the home. We want to go back to the house because of that home environment and because of the love that they felt there. It was just more of a relaxed environment.
Rosemary, do you feel that that's kind of a similar situation and that smaller, more family, tight-knit kind of home
Absolutely.
Thing helps?
Absolutely. That's the basis of really a recovery residence. You know, it's that family in that home together. They share similar experiences. They all have the goal of wanting a strong, healthy, sober living lifestyle for the remaining of their lives. So they're there to help each other. They say their grace. They may be very much involved in their own churches, but and that's something that they do either together or on their own, but it's not something that we require them to do. It's something that they want.
It makes me a little nervous, though, about next steps because it's not a cheap place to live. People have to save up a lot of money to go get an apartment. And then once they do, they're kind of on their own. And it's also an economic struggle. So what kind of things do you do after when people, I don't want to say graduate, but when they leave the group home, then what kind of support is there afterwards?
There's always support available. Many of our folks are in the AA, NACA world.
And Amber talked a little bit about somebody going to meetings.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So you would suggest maybe sticking with meetings. And people can continue with your ministry, right?
Oh, yeah. And we require meetings, you know, in our home. So,
but once people leave and they go and get their own apartment and they're off on their own, they can come back?
Oh, of course. Anytime. Yeah.
Do you have a lot of that?
Some of them do. In fact, we have a family that was with us for a season and they're doing absolutely amazing. He actually started a business while he was with us. And now he's got his own company with, you know, I think a 6-man crew and doing absolutely amazing. Him and his family, my wife and I, we took custody of their kids, got them out of foster care, and they continuously come back and give back. Yeah.
And Patricia, I think that your reporting is going to continue because as the state attorney was mentioning, with the unscrupulous, the not real nice guys out there with some of these sober homes that are using it as a scam, will you be continuing to follow that and try to vet those out or root them out?
I might. But Julie, I want to just say that while I appreciate and agree with what State Attorney Ehrenberg has said about the bad actors in sober homes and for that matter, in all of addiction and recovery.
It was kind of a cottage industry on the other coast, he said.
It is. And I'm sure that I see heads nodding that it has happened here. But I just want to emphasize that right now, you know, there are a lot of people using on the street who want to get off the street. And many of those people don't have private payability. They don't have insurance, all right? They will go to detox and go straight into a home like Pastor Craig's or even yours, you know, perhaps.
So and, the need is there.
And while that can create a lot of issues, and Amber, you might know something about this because, you know, Amber went to a treatment program on a grant. But some people don't. So they come in without any resilience, any ability to tolerate stress, what have mm-hmm. you. They are going to relapse. That is going to happen in a sober home. But many people don't have an alternative to that. And that is better than absolutely better than nothing. And I will be looking at you know, I'm actually moving on to look right now at detox and
all right.
the fragmentation of our services.
Well, we went the full hour, didn't even take a break,
okay,
and we've run out of time.
Okay.
I am so sorry,
no
but worries. I'm going to have to wrap it up. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and myself. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.